From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rap music and the culture of violence. We talk with Eric Davis, who spent 10 years as an undercover cop patrolling Chicago's housing projects. He's also a member of the rap group, the Slick Boys. He speaks to young people in Chicago and around the country about the consequences of violence. We'll find out how the drive-by shootings of rap stars Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls have affected the young people Davis works with. Also, medical ethics in the age of managed care. We talk with medical ethicist Art Kaplan and Robert Baker, who's researching the history of medical ethics. They recently organized a conference on the 150th anniversary of the AMA's Code of Ethics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Officials investigating the apparent suicides of 39 people near San Diego say the victims have been dead for some time. They made that conclusion from the smell of decay in the rented mansion where the bodies were found. Deputies first at the scene say the smell was so bad they first feared there was poison gas in the house. Autopsies are being conducted today to find how the people died, but authorities say it looks like a mass ritualistic suicide. The National Cancer Institute has recommended routine mammograms for women aged 40 to 49. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
In the early 1990s, the Cancer Institute recommended screening for women in their 40s, but then dropped the recommendation in 1993, saying there weren't enough data to prove it would help. But armed with new information from two Swedish studies, the Institute is now calling for mammograms every 1 to 2 years for women in their 40s, and more frequently for women at higher risk. That recommendation moves the NCI closer to the American Cancer Society, but is counter to what a government panel said in January, when it suggested that women consult with their doctors. The NCI was under great pressure from the U.S. Senate, which recently voted 98-0 in favor of mammograms for women in their 40s. But while going along with the new recommendation, the head of the NCI's advisory board said it could change once more data are in. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
James Earl Ray told the son of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. today he didn't kill the civil rights leader in 1968. King told Ray that he and his family believe Ray's story. A Zairean rebel leader says negotiations to end Zaire's civil war could open in a few days. The rebel leader is attending an African summit along with a representative of Zairean President Mobutu Sese Seko. Both officials met face-to-face for the first time in the presence of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The agreement to talk is a big step, and both sides have compromised to get there. Zaire's government backed away from its demand for a ceasefire before negotiations. The rebels no longer insist on talking directly with President Mobutu. Foreign pressure on both sides, which became intense in the last week, certainly helped. But the path from here is not clear. The rebels say they will only sit down with those who truly represent the president. Mobutu has proposed sending a negotiating team drawn from Zaire's government, parliament, and political parties. Mobutu will also want a quick ceasefire to end his army's battlefield losses, while the rebels have little incentive to stop fighting now that they are poised to capture Zaire's main diamond and mineral-producing regions. No date has been set for the talks expected to take place in Togo or South Africa. This is Michael Scholar in Kinshasa.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 61 points at 6,819. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is lower. The Dow Jones Industrials are off more than 60 points. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are debating the outlook for future interest rate increases from the Federal Reserve after the day's economic news showed unexpected strength. Home resales jumped during February to the second highest level on record, and the number of first-time jobless claims surprisingly fell last week. These reports, in turn, have pushed long-term interest rates to their highest level in more than 5 months, and that's weighing on the stock market. On an otherwise down day, shares in Quaker Oats are higher after the company agreed to sell its money-losing Snapple beverage unit to Triarch Companies for $300 million. I'm Doug Krisner.
AT&T says it will lay off 800 workers in its markets division. Management jobs are the ones that are most targeted. The layoffs are part of the reorganization begun last year when 17,000 job cuts were announced. So far, AT&T has cut about 9,000 of those jobs. The United Auto Workers and General Motors reached a tentative contract early today to settle a 13-day strike at GM's truck assembly plant in Fort Wayne, Indiana. No details of the pact are yet known, but a local union spokesman says the deal was hammered out after a 43-hour bargaining session. About 2,700 UAW members walked off the job March 14th. They'd been without a contract for 8 months. Many complain the factory is understaffed and GM forces them to work too much overtime. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 61 points at 6,819. The Nasdaq is off 4 points at 1,264. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two stars of the rap music world have been murdered recently in drive-by shootings. 6 months ago, Tupac Shakur was killed. This month, it was Biggie Smalls, who also recorded under the name The Notorious B.I.G. Tupac was from L.A., Biggie from New York. One theory is that their murders were connected to an ongoing rivalry between East Coast and West Coast rap empires. My guest, Eric Davis, works with young people who live in the world gangster rap describes. Davis spent 10 years as an undercover cop in Chicago working the housing projects. He's also a rapper in a group with two other Chicago cops called the Slick Boys. Their videos are shown on TV, and they travel around the country performing and talking with young people about the real consequences of violence. Davis is too famous to remain undercover, so now he does service work in the projects. He grew up in the Cabrini Green Project in Chicago. Before we talk about the impact of the murders, let's hear a track from Biggie Smalls' new record released posthumously this week. This track is called You're Nobody Till Somebody Kills You.
The kid's the dog, everybody dying, no lying. So don't you get suspicious. I'm big, dangerous, you're just a little vicious as I leave my competition. Respirator style, climb the ladder to success, escalator style. Hold y'all, breath I told y'all, death controls y'all, big don't fold y'all. I spit phrases that'll thrill you. You're nobody till somebody kills you.
You're nobody till somebody kills you.
I asked cop and rapper Eric Davis to share some of the reactions to the rap star murders that he's heard from young people in the housing projects.
Well, many of the youngsters, and this is very scary for us, you know, they believe that, you know, if this can happen to Tupac and this can happen to Biggie, then I'm absolutely right in wanting to carry a gun because they're rappers and they're really not into the mix of things per se. The drug dealing, the gang banging. And for a lot of the kids, it has them running scared. And what we're doing at this point is we're sitting down and we're trying to talk out the situation. What we want these youngsters to realize is that when you make the wrong choices, when you make the wrong decisions, it doesn't matter if you're Tupac, Biggie, President Clinton. If you're with the wrong type of people and you're doing the wrong things, bad things can happen. And we try to bring it down to a level that they can understand in their lives. And we try to explain to them that there's no, it's not necessarily a thing that you have to be afraid of. You just have to start making the right decisions. And making the right decisions doesn't say begin at 10 years old and all of a sudden you're 20 and you don't have to make the right decisions anymore. But once you start making the right decisions, you have to make them for the rest of your life. Because your life may depend on making the right decision.
The reality of the murders of Tupac and Biggie, do you think that that's making young people more afraid of their own possible death and just kind of underscoring that where there's guns, there's murder?
Well, Terry, I think a lot of these kids are much more sophisticated than we as parents are giving them credit for. You know, in a community like the one I worked, I mean, these kids know murder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know about murder. part of the problem, I think, is that many of us are only shocked when we see that Tupac Shakur or Biggie Smalls is killed. Yet, we won't even take a walk to look around America and see that this is happening every day. And yes, it's shocking that Tupac and Biggie were killed, but I'm just as shocked when the 15-year-old Tommy Jones walks down the street and is killed. You know, yeah, he doesn't have any videos out, but you know what? I think the pain is still going to be the same to his mom as it was to Tupac's and Biggie's. And I don't understand as a society why we can't feel that pain.
Biggie Smalls or the Notorious B.I.G. has a new album coming out that's called Life After Death. Mm-hmm. One of the tracks on it is called You're Nobody Till Somebody Kills You. Do you think that record was prophesizing his own death, or it's just a kind of genre, you know, that those kinds of words, life after death, are just part of the genre?
Well, I think it's part of everyday living in many communities that he travels through. I think the reason kids are involved in such reckless, dangerous behavior is because, once again, they're sold the idea that you're only going to live to be 18. You're only going to live to be 20. So these kids are trying to live fast. If that means selling crack cocaine, if that means selling ill lyrics on records to make a ton of money, then they're going to do what they have to do. And if you're going to live, you have to talk about dying in many communities, because you see death on a daily basis. You hear about death on a daily basis. So I don't know if it's a thing that they're afraid of death or they're honoring death, but it's something that you have to deal with on a daily basis. So it's something that you deal with.
In the current edition of Source, a magazine about hip-hop and rap, Biggie Smalls is interviewed. He was interviewed shortly before he died. And he was talking about becoming famous and how becoming well-known was changing him and maybe changing his music. I've changed a couple of the quotes for radio, but he said, "You couldn't really expect me to still be doing screwed up stuff on Life After Death because it would be kind of phony. Like, oh, how can he say he still robs and steals if he sold 2 million records? I got a newborn son. I'm trying to blossom more into being a father and a man, more than just a buck wild teenage nigger that was just out there wildin'." And then in the rap documentary Rhyme and Reason, he said, "The hardest thing I've ever had to overcome is really just making the transition from being a street hustling nigger to like a star." I'm wondering if you feel you've watched people who have become famous, who suddenly had celebrity and money, and try to deal with that and can't, just find it really hard to change or to get out of the neighborhood or get away from violence.
Well, I think that transition is hard for anyone. And you have to understand, when you're programmed to believe one way all your life, and that is, you know, what they say on the street is the props come to the gangster. And that being, you know, the guy that's the tough guy, the bad boy in the neighborhood, he gets all the respect. He gets all the dignity. He gets all the glory. And now you sold 2 million records. You're kind of like a regular guy. You just happen to be rich, but you're not seen as hard and tough anymore. And being hard and tough in many communities that are poor is what protects you. Your reputation is what protects you. And now that you have a little something, now that puts you on the endangered species list. Because now people think, wow, since he has a little money and a little fame, he's gotten soft. So now when you tell me about all these things that are tough things that you did, they're not believable anymore, because you know what? I'm not crazy enough to believe that a guy that sells 2 million records has to go out and snatch gold chains and sell crack cocaine. So you don't understand the life that I'm living anymore. You're out of the circle. And for a lot of guys that all their life they've been in the circle, and that's where I'm comfortable at, now I have a problem. Where do I belong? Do I belong out in the rich suburbs, where I'm still not liked? Or do I belong here in the hood, where it's going to be a little dangerous, where they don't want me, where they're turning their back on me, saying I don't understand anymore, that I've changed, that I'm different? But I think part of the change could have occurred if more people would get involved in many of the poor communities and show that, hold it, being a ball player or being a rap star, those aren't the things that are real about our community. There are people that go to work every day, pay their mortgage every day or pay their rent, struggle to take care of their kids. And I think then the transition would have been a little easier for Biggie and for Tupac. And I think definitely the money and the fame and the fortune is really what contributed partly to their death also.
Yeah, some of the rap performers are saying that they're getting a little scared now. Ice-T told a rap radio station that he felt unsafe for the first time. And Snoop postponed his tour for safety reasons, and when it starts, he's going to have more security. Have you spoken to performers about trying to stay safe after they've made it?
Well, what's funny is that, once again, Terry, when you're from the neighborhood, you really think that, you know, these are my boys, these are my guys. I don't have to worry about this. I don't have to worry about the danger because they know that I got their back and they've got mine. But you've transcended to a different place. And many feel that you've left me behind. So there's a bit of jealousy. There's a bit of animosity. There's a bit of how could you make it and I not make it? And for many, they're blind to see this danger that's around them. But I think when you talk about the Biggie and you talk about the Tupac situation, you also have to look at the forces that were involved. You have to look at the record companies. You have to look at the street gangs that were involved in both of their careers, who I've said for years and still say are the Black Mafia. And you're talking about a company in Death Row Records that made $100 million. There are a lot more issues than the lyrics in a rap song that caused the problems that killed these two young men. And I think the potential is there for a lot more violence and murder if the true issues aren't attacked and aren't really spoken about.
My guest is rapper and Chicago cop Eric Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with rapper and Chicago cop Eric Davis. You know, there's a lot of theories about what's behind the murders of Tupac and Biggie. There, you know, one theory is that it's a feud between East Coast and West Coast rappers. Another theory is that it's people with a lot of money in the record industry doing paybacks. Another theory is that it's tied in with the Crips and the Bloods because the two big record labels involved here have their connections to the Crips and the Bloods. What are some of the popular theories on the streets now? What do you find that young people most believe? And what are some of the theories that they're subscribing to?
Well, I'll give you a theory. How's that?
Yeah, go ahead.
You have to understand that the record business, no matter how many records you sell as an artist, the artist really doesn't make that much money off of his records. He makes a percentage, but not that large of a portion. He really makes his money off of doing concerts, selling his T-shirts. So now if I have a problem with a guy and I'm from L.A. and I can't do concerts on the East Coast, that's affecting my money. And that's affecting a large part of my money. Death Row Records is heavily influenced by the Blood Street Gang. That's a fact. The Bloods are the ones that paid $1 million bond to get Tupac Shakur out of jail. So now if Tupac can't make my money back because of some feud that these gangs see as trivial because they want their money back, now we have some problems. And now, the guy that I spent $1 million to get out of jail is killed in this nonsense. Now I have no opportunity to get my money back. We have a larger problem. Hence, now Biggie shot dead. And the gang that was supposedly doing security for Biggie at the time were the Crips. So how the street gang and the mob and the money and all of that wasn't included in this ideology, I don't know. And I think all of these things I'm telling you are pretty common knowledge. Are pretty common knowledge.
So you're saying you're pretty confident that this is forces larger than violence in the neighborhood, that it has to do with record companies and deals, and that street gangs might be involved too. And it's all about power and money.
It's about money, definitely, and it's about power. And what had happened with both of them in this argument is that Biggie couldn't come to the West Coast, and Tupac couldn't come to the East Coast, and Snoop Dogg couldn't come to the East Coast. And what that does, bottom line, is that affects money.
And why couldn't they come?
Well, violence and retribution over an argument.
There was a Newsweek cover story recently about the generation gap within African-American families, parents appalled by gangster rap, young people really loving it, not wanting to hear about the parents' experiences in the civil rights movement. I wonder if that concurs with your observations.
Well, I can agree with that to a point, but I think the one deteriorating factor that I see is that, you know, it's a thing now in our country that everybody's trying to get more. You know, parents are just trying to go out and work, and they're really not supervising what their kids are seeing, what their kids are doing. When their kids say, I'm going out of the house, they don't ask, where are you going? Who are you going to be with? They just say, they're out of the house. When their kids say they're going to buy a CD, they don't ask, what's on the CD? And part of that problem is that we're losing that line of communication, just basic, simple communication, where our time to communicate with our parents was 6 o'clock every evening. I don't know many homes in this country that I could ask a kid, and we go all over the country and ask, what time is dinner time? The kids scratch their heads and are like, what are you talking about? What's dinner time? And dinner time was definitely the time that you got an opportunity to express your feelings, what was going on in your life, what was expected of you, you found out. And I don't think we have that raw, basic communication within our homes anymore. And that's not just in the black community. That's from top to bottom. And I think once that occurs, then the kids go out to the street and they start to communicate with each other. And we just need to say, hey, I'm going to take this job of being a parent seriously. I'm not just going to be a parent for the kids in my house. I'm going to be a parent for the kids that come with my kids to my house. And that's how we change what's going on with gangster rap. That's how we change what's going on in our communities. That's what we change what's going on with this country.
You're too famous now to work as an undercover cop, famous for your raps, famous for the show New York Undercover, which is based in part on your story. But you're still a cop, and you're still working with young people in the projects. Tell us about the kind of work that you're doing now and the impact that you hope it will have.
Well, what we were tired of is coming on programs and talking about the 100 reasons why kids are doing what they're doing. And no one would ever talk about what they were going to go out to do to make a change. And what we decided to do was we decided that we were going to take all our money from the TV show New York Undercover, and we were going to put it into the community to start to make change. And you always say that, yeah, you know, this is probably the last thing I'll do, then I'm just going to go back to being a cop. But you see that there are so many things that are necessary for you to do. And now what we've done is we've opened up in the Robert Taylor Housing Development a learning center where we have 45 computers. We have a GED class that's given every day and every night. We have a nursery so parents can bring their children to school, so there's no excuse why you can't come every day. We have job training that we give on the computers. We have a weight room so we can get young men lifting weights, feeling good about their body, making it more difficult to want to put alcohol and drugs in their body. And now we've just connected with a job program that helps to teach kids how to sit through interviews and do resumes, and now we even have jobs that are saying, look, we have 3 and 4 jobs for you once they go through your program and your process. And we're getting ready to open up a new center down at the Wentworth Gardens Housing Development, which is over near Comiskey Park here in Chicago also. And we're just trying to truly get to the root of the problem to try to make a difference. And all we expect back from the children that we help is that they, in fact, come back to the community and give a helping hand to try to make a positive change, not just for the community, but for America, because it's a shame that there are so many bright, bright, bright people within many of these communities that are locked in that could really improve the quality of life of this country who aren't getting an opportunity. So what we're trying to do is just to bring opportunity.
You were an undercover cop for 10 years, and a lot of the young people who you work with are now adults. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you look at some of the people who you've become fairly close to mm-hmm. over the years, do you feel like you're optimistic about people's ability to get out of a tougher life, to change, or to make a safe place for themselves in a world that's pretty unsafe?
Well, I just know it's possible. And I get a lot of good positive feedback every day when I run into kids that their parents have named them after us. I get a lot of positive feedback when the kids come up and call me Uncle Eric, and their parents, who a lot of them I've had turbulent times with, come up and give me a hug every time they see me, and they say, you know what, I think you saved my life. And that's worth more than a pot of gold, because you know you've made a positive impact. And what we're trying to do is to just continue striving to make this place a little better, because I think when it all comes down to it, it's not what kind of car you have and how many gold chains like the rap records tell you and how many girls with big behinds you got. It's about what'd you do to make this place a better place. And that doesn't make you any softer, because all the kids in my neighborhoods that I go to know that I'm still the man. And I can still kick everybody's butt, but I can be nice and I can be soft, and I don't even have to go there and dig that thing out. It's a lot nicer and a lot safer for all of us to treat each other respectably than to have to be on guard of each other and from each other.
When Tupac was murdered, a lot of young people were kind of in denial and were saying, no, he's not really dead. Do you think that there was that same disbelief after Biggie got killed?
No. You know what I think the problem for Biggie was? He happened to be the second one killed. So now, you know, they really believed, wow, he's dead. But Machiavelli, who Tupac also calls himself, he must still be out there, because it was still kind of shocking for them that to believe that Tupac, who said he was so hard and so tough and above all of this, who was a gangster and now he's made all this money, I can't believe that somebody killed him. And that was kind of their way to hold on. But now once Biggie was killed, you know, they're like, hey, this is real. This is happening.
Eric Davis is a policeman in Chicago and a member of the rap group The Slick Boys. His experiences with his partners as undercover cops inspired the TV series New York Undercover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, medical ethics versus business ethics in the era of managed care. We talk with bioethicist Art Kaplan and medical historian Robert Baker. They recently organized a conference on the 150th anniversary of the AMA's Code of Ethics. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Doctors are facing new and confounding ethical questions dealing with life support systems, doctor-assisted suicide, the genetics revolution, and the business ethics of managed care. Doctors and medical ethicists recently gathered at a conference about the AMA's Code of Ethics, which was first drafted 150 years ago. The conference asked how the code needs to be updated to address contemporary ethical dilemmas. My guests are two of the conference's organizers. Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert Baker is a visiting scholar at the center and teaches the history of medicine at Union College in Schenectady. Art Kaplan says the code still has relevance today.
As I read the old code, it clearly was written at a time of moral confusion in medicine 150 years ago. Different problems. I think one of the things that was bothering medicine was, are we a profession? What kind of educational requirements do we want to put in for doctors? How are we going to deal with our rivals who claim to be able to cure people but maybe use more testimonial and less evidence in terms of what they're doing? I don't think the specifics of the code are going to help work through today's problems, but the notion of using a code to answer a particular moral crisis, I think that still speaks very loudly and very materially to what's going on today.
Before we get back to the crisis in medicine today, let's look back at the crisis 150 years ago when the code was first written. Bob Baker, you've really been studying the history of the medical code. Why did doctors decide they needed a formal code 150 years ago?
If you looked at medicine in 1847, you'd see that every state that had previously licensed physicians had taken away their licenses because they viewed licensing as elitist. You'd see that every attempt to establish a scientific medicine in America had basically failed. You'd see that the only thing that you needed to practice medicine in America was an MD, and there were no requirements whatsoever for getting an MD, so that in effect, bad education, cheap education, short education, education without content was giving people the right to call themselves a doctor, and bad doctors were driving out good doctors.
Had the public lost faith in the doctors?
The public utterly had lost faith in qualified doctors, and the doctors needed some way to say, we are different because we're scientists, and you should choose us and not our competition. But even more than that, they needed some reason to think of themselves as being different. They needed some mechanism to get together and challenge their problems, because their problems were not only external, they were the inability of the medical community to agree on basic rudimentary ways of treating patients. There were no standards of care. Basic medicine, there was no standard pharmacopoeia or a formula for making up drugs. The bare rudiments of medicine did not exist in America in 1847.
I'd like each of you to just pull out a couple of principles from the AMA's Code of Ethics, the code drafted 150 years ago, and tell us why you think these were very important principles for the medical profession. Art, you want to take it first?
Well, one of the driving values in the 1847 code, and startling mm-hmm. in some ways because it's there, is the notion of selflessly treating the poor. That what you're called upon to do by this code, which if you look at it from 1997 perspective is just remarkable, is you're supposed to be willing to treat people without ability to pay. And you don't worry about that. Today, we go to the doctor, we go to the hospital. I think the first thing that happens is someone says, you got your insurance card and maybe a waiver after that to get in the emergency room or get in to see the doctor. 1847, the profession says, look, we are a profession, but what part of what our duty is here is to treat people regardless of their ability to pay. And if they're poor and we have to treat them for free, we ought to do that. Just a remarkable forswearing of kind of financial interest in favor of patient interest.
Name another.
Another part of the code, I don't know if it's a precept, I'll boil it down to a single value, is you're supposed to accept danger. These are people who are working in 1847. They got cholera. They got infectious diseases all over the place. The code calls upon them and it says, you have to take personal risk. If you're a doctor, if you're a physician, this is not the same as other professions. You've got to go out there and you're going to get infected, you risk your life. You think about that in the world of AIDS, hepatitis, Ebola. A lot of doctors these days are thinking, well, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm really going to go out there and expose myself to an AIDS-infected patient as a surgeon. 1847, the notion is, if we're going to command society's respect, if we're going to get privilege, if we're going to have our due as a profession, we've got to show we're willing to bear personal risk.
Bob Baker, choose a couple of the principles from the code that you think have been very important.
My favorite actually is not in the code, but it was the principle that structured the code. Code was written by John Bell and Isaac Hayes. Bell wanted a basic principle underlying all American medical ethics, and the principle he chose was reciprocity. And the idea is, if we as a profession serve the public and our patients, they would reciprocate and respect us. Given that principle, in order to get their licenses back, in order to get public respect, they had to figure out how best to serve both the public, and Art just pointed out two of the most important ways in which they attempted to serve the public, and the individual patient. And it starts out with a statement that the physician will come when called. That is, they'll make house calls. They'll make house calls on anybody, and they'll do it irrespective of questions about payment. It then continues to say that we will treat our patients with attention, fidelity, humanity. An interesting notion, condescension, which may be understood, but it meant at the time that we would explain to our patients what we were doing to them and why. It also goes on to say that we will treat our patients tenderly, which is an interesting concept, and with delicacy, we'll keep their secrets. And it goes on for the first time ever in the history of any medical profession. It lays out a series of duties that the doctor has to a patient and therefore gives the patient a series of rights. So implicit in this document was a very rich list of patient rights that any patient who called on an AMA physician would have against those.
Now, Bob, you say after, about 50 years or so, a lot of doctors rebelled against the code of ethics. What was that rebellion about?
There is in these rebellions both a covert and an overt message. The official message is we want freedom to consult with whoever we want and to abide by our own standards of what's right and wrong. The freedom was to consult with homeopaths and alternative practitioners. That was the watchword. But underneath that is that doctors, especially specialists, could make extraordinary amounts of money by practicing their specialties, and they basically became restive with treating the poor patients in particular for free. The rebellion started in New York City, of course, which is the home of the specialist. It started in the 1880s, and in 1903, in New Orleans, it almost succeeded totally, and it did eviscerate the code by undercutting, by removing all enforcement provisions. There was a 10-year liberal hiatus in which medical ethics was no longer enforced in the United States, although the code existed in name. And in 1912, some parts of the force of the code were restored, but it never was the same tough, rich document that it was in 1847.
So the specialists broke away from the code and they had no ethics on paper guiding them?
That's correct. And the specialist societies they founded basically did not issue alternative or codes of ethics. And if you take a look, peeking up to the modern era in the era from 1950s to the 1970s, when there are a series of scandals that rock American medicine, they all came from the same two groups that broke from the AMA in 1903, and that is the specialist and the research scientist. And in both cases, they were interested in following specialty areas of interest, treating their patients as subjects. They sacrificed them in the name of science, and we had scandals like the scandal at Tuskegee at just down the corner from here, Jewish chronic disease and Jennings and Memorial Hospitals, and a series of others that rocked the country.
My guests are Robert Baker and Art Kaplan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I have two guests. Bob Baker is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics, and he teaches medical ethics at Union College in Schenectady. And Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he organized a recent conference on the 150th anniversary of the AMA's Code of Ethics. I think one of the big crises for doctors now has to do with medical ethics versus business ethics, because many doctors are working for, you know, managed healthcare companies whose goal is to cut costs, keep costs low so that profit can be made. And there are incentives to do less testing, to give less care so that the care is cheaper. Art Kaplan, is there anything in the Medical Code of Ethics that can guide doctors through those tough decisions about medical versus business issues?
Well, I think that's really where we're at now, Terry. You've got business ethics looking like it's replacing medical ethics. And I think the number one complaint that doctors have is they feel that their advocacy, their ability to advocate for their patients, is being undercut by these outside constraints of money and management by non-medical people, MBAs replacing MDs, if you want to put it in simple terms. Patient worry is, gosh, how am I going to trust my doctor these days? Is he or she really going to do what's right for me, or am I going to get a drive-through delivery or a one-day mastectomy because these people are reporting to businessmen and stockholders who just don't care about quality of care? I think the code has to speak to this. My own view is both the AMA code, other codes of ethics are not doing it yet. They haven't touched base with that older tradition that said, if you want to be a profession and you want to hold the esteem of the American people and you want to be trusted, you must show yourself as willing to put personal interest, that's willingness to take risk in the old terms about getting sick or infected, and putting aside money interests to stand for your patient. I think they're inching that way a little bit, but the disease threat, the threat of cost and money all over the place, it requires a much more serious response than they're giving it yet. I think the bioethicists are yelling, come on, we've got to make sure that the one thing you can't have any doubt about is when you go to see the doctor, you better be sure that that doctor is for you first and foremost. I'm not sure they've met that challenge yet.
Well, now doctors are employees. I mean, doctors always had to answer to a hierarchy at the hospital, but the hospital was run by medical people too. But now they're working for HMOs and they're employees in a way of business interests. And so who's there to support the doctor if the doctor idealistically calls on a principal and says, I cannot compromise my code as a doctor and I cannot do this? Well, then he gets bounced or something. I mean, what's there to protect him?
Nothing. And in fact, we just went through a round of this. We heard about last year, all the rage was a discussion of gag rules. The doctors can't tell you this, doctors can't tell you that. How medicine could put itself in a position where it would put up with any of this? I mean, being told that you can't discuss options or alternatives or give full information is absolutely morally out of the question. It seems to me organized medicine was so on the run, so beaten down, so pummeled by this drive from business and third-party payers and government to get those costs down that they abandoned ship. They basically bailed out and said, okay, we're just employees. They've got to put together their organizational clout. And secondly, they've got to look for allies in new places. I think they can't do it alone. They've got to join up with those patients again. They've got to be seen as the patient's ally and be trying to muster political support to say, look, it's not just our interest. It's not my salary that's being cut that leads me to want to challenge the HMO. It's because your quality of care is going down or I can't talk to you freely. You've got to stand with me, patient, so we can take on this juggernaut together.
I understand that some doctors are joining unions so that they have some clout when it, not only in terms of money, but when they want to make a decision that they can considered ethical, and their HMO is urging them in the other direction. Do you see this as a trend that's going to keep growing? Bob, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's ironic because a profession, by definition, is you control your own agenda, and therefore you're not an employee or a laborer. I think myself, to define yourself as a laborer and to form yourself into a union is to begin to accept that other people set the agenda, and it's already to begin to concede defeat. I don't see that as the first or the optimal strategy for the profession. I think, as and I'm in total agreement with Art, the profession should take the high ground. It has to redefine its interest in terms of its patient's interest, in terms of the public's interest, and it should do such things as, one, very simple idea, and I think the AMA is actually working on this, have a report card, a checklist that patients can use to see whether or not their HMO, their IPA, their managed care organization is giving them the sorts of things that in the AMA's view it thinks ought to be given. Have 800 numbers that the physicians working for managed care can call to get to the AMA if in fact they have gag rules, if in fact they feel that their rights as physicians to protect the public and their patients are being infringed. I think that it's clear that American medicine ought to organize. It ought to organize around medical values, around serving the patient, and it ought to do that in a variety of ways that are powerful but need not allow that the management has the right to shape the agenda. And I think if you form a union, you've basically given management that right, at least in America.
I just add one other point. I think unionization is a disaster. The power of unionization is to withhold services. It's to strike. I can't imagine medicine as a field being one of those areas where you withhold your services if you don't get what you want. So I think going that road without the major power in your hands of being able to go on strike or withhold services, which I don't think the American people would put up with for long, is a disaster for medicine. The other reason I think unionization is not the road to go, although I understand full well why many doctors think it's the road they better travel, is it accepts the terms of the debate. It just says, okay, it is money, and we're going to fight for our interests relative to those managers and cost containers who are crushing down our interests. But unions don't necessarily speak up for the public interest. They speak up for the employees' interests, and I don't think that's where medicine wants to be. It needs that trust as part of that doctor-patient relationship, and I'm not sure unionization is going to be the way to cement that.
What do you think doctors and patients need to do to ensure that there are still medical ethics?
Out there somewhere? Well, I think a couple of things have to happen. First, organized medicine has to say, all right, you can take us seriously. We do want to work with you. We will be willing to make some concessions in terms of where we need to go with American healthcare. If it is, in fact, inevitable that we've got to get our costs contained, then let's do it in a public and accountable way. One of the things that terrifies me these days about how cost containment is proceeding in America is going on behind closed doors. It happens at stockholders' meetings and in boardroom meetings. The profession has to jump up and say, look, we want these decisions made. We want them made on medical grounds, not according to what's cheapest or what is appeals to the CEO of a particular organization. So they have to press with patients for publicity and accountability, openness about how decisions are going to be made. I think the second thing that profession has to do with patients is basically say, look, we're going to protect your privacy. We are losing privacy. It's like people talk about the loss of the rainforest in, you know, whatever it is, 1,000 acres a day. Privacy is eroding all around us. We go into the hospital, we wave it off, and 100 people can see our records. Who knows how many bureaucrats are looking at our personal and private medical records at insurance companies. Medicine has to get in and say, nope, we're going to restore that to you. It's essential to your dignity. It's essential to your self-worth. We're going to fight to get that back. And the last recommendation I would make about physician-patient alliances is I think that medicine has to stand up and say, look, we will never be gagged. You can always depend on us to tell you the truth. Even if you can't get what we're telling you you might need, we will tell you so that you can raise a stink about it. It just doesn't cohere with trust in medicine to have people believe that they're not getting the full story from the doctor. So they have to swear that no matter what goes on, they'll never accept management forms that gag or restrict or in any way limit communication. That's just not compatible with good medical ethics.
My guests are Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and Robert Baker, a visiting scholar at the center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with bioethicist Art Kaplan and Professor Robert Baker, who teaches the history of medical ethics. They recently helped organize a conference on the AMA's Code of Ethics. Bob, I want to ask you another question about where we are now compared to where we were 150 years ago when the AMA adopted the Medical Code of Ethics. One of the issues 150 years ago is what does it take to be a real doctor as opposed to just somebody posing as a doctor who wasn't really qualified? And what was the difference between a real certified medical doctor and somebody who knew some unconventional stuff and claimed to be able to heal you, but they weren't really a doctor? Some parallel today is the rift between medical doctors and people practicing non-conventional therapies or alternative therapies that are actually quite traditional in other parts of the world, but not in the United States, like acupuncture, or more modern versions of that, various herbal remedies, homeopathy. And what response do you see doctors having, and what response, what do you think they could learn historically about how to deal with alternatives?
Well, one thing we know is since one of the objectives in 1847 was to respond successfully to these challenges by convincing the public that regular conventional medicine works, since that succeeded in 1847, you have to follow the same, you should follow the same strategy in 1997. If people go to alternative medicine, it's not, for some, it's clearly a lifestyle choice. I mean, they don't like living conventionally and they don't like going to conventional doctors, and that's fine. For others, it's because they have lost faith in what conventional medicine has to offer. And the way in which you reassert that faith is not to bludgeon people over the head, but to show people what you have to offer and to do it well.
One interesting tension, and I don't have an answer for this, and I don't know what modern medicine can do about this. When people seek out alternative healers today, I do think part of the answer is for American medicine to step up to the plate and say, no, our conventional interventions are better. We can get better results. The other reason people go there, though, is they're looking for somebody to talk to them. They want some personal interaction. They don't want people who come and spend 15 seconds at the bedside or have nothing to say when someone finds out they've got breast cancer or dying. For a long time, we've been yelling within bioethics about improving communication and spending more time talking with patients, and that this aspect of illness has to be addressed, too. I'm a little bit in despair about whether this is going to be possible in the sort of technological medicine that we've got. I used to think, well, if we could just yell loud enough, what the AMA and organized medicine could do is call for change in medical education and continuing education. But when you look at managed care today, with its 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes per patient, you see in the high-tech areas where people are very sick, people trying to master all this machinery and teams of people running around, it may be that one of the things that medicine has to do is specialize the communication side so that it is captured, but maybe not something that everyone is expected to do. Otherwise, I think people will continue to go on to the alternative sides, not just for cure, but also for conversation, just for basic interpersonal interaction when they don't feel well, or they're sick, or they're desperate. And I'm not sure medicine has figured out what the answer to that's going to be. It has a lot of constraints that make it tough to do that kind of work within mainstream medicine.
Can I put a word in for alternative medicine? I mean, there always ought to be alternative medicine. It would be a mistake for there not to be. It's, as Paul Wolpe, who's also at the center, points out, an incubator for new ideas. It's a place for people who feel uncomfortable with the conventions. It's a mode of not scientific experimentation, but human-style experimentation, lifestyle experimentation. And sometimes, rarely, it gives you scientific breakthroughs. But by and large, it's with the modes of delivery and human interaction that alternative medicine serves a real and important alternative to the conventional practice.
Is there anything you see happening now in medical education that you're optimistic about?
Yes. I think that a couple of things have happened. One, there are now required courses on medical ethics for all medical students at a lot of medical schools. I think also students are finding it very common to be able to talk about some of these health policy issues, learn a little health economics, get a handle on what this health maintenance organization, managed care phenomenon is all about. And in the continuing medical education arena, I think people are starting to realize, well, we can introduce discussions as we develop and evolve as doctors, nurses, healthcare providers that open up some of these ethics questions and cases too. It doesn't have to all be technical training. We can do ethics training. So I think some of that has started to shift and that's been for the good. We need a lot more, but I think there are areas where that's changing and changing for the better.
Bob Baker?
Also, the MBA side of the equation should not be neglected. One of the things I do, and I know a lot of bioethicists are beginning to do, is teach medical ethics to the people getting MBAs in healthcare to make sure that the next generation of HMO managers are ethically sensitive and know something about the traditions of medical ethics.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about medical ethics and medical code. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
Pleasure.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert Baker is a visiting scholar at the center and a professor at Union College in Schenectady. Well, time to say goodbye to our ace researcher, Siobhan Roth. But we're not just saying goodbye, we're saying congratulations on her new job with the Legal Times. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Dorothy Farabee. Research assistance from Sarah Shore. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Don't send me no doctor, filling me up with all of those pills. I got me a man named Dr. Feelgood. It all, yeah, that man takes care of all of my pains and my ills. His name is Dr. Feelgood.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of A Place of My Own, The Education of an Amateur Builder by Michael Pollan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.